Well, ladies and gentlemen, a treat today. I've got Alec Hogg of Biz News. I mean, this is an unusual thing. I'm interviewing you for a change. Welcome to the show.
Thanks, Byron.
Lots of people know of Biz News. You've obviously had an exponential explosion on your channel, which is great. It's lovely to see. And you've obviously had a lot of success. You interview a lot of people. You know, there must be a story behind Biz News. What is it? Why did you start it?
Well, I guess you could call me a digital pioneer. I started MoneyWeb in 1996 above my garage. Went into business radio, started business radio in South Africa, the first business radio show. I had the misfortune of moving it across to various channels, and every time I left, well, not with 702. They came and stole Bruce from me, and then he did a very good job for 702. But MoneyWeb was a successful, good business. I took a little break in 2010. I went farming horses in KwaZulu-Natal. And at that stage, we appointed a new CEO. He had quite exciting ideas. He did a joint venture with Caxton. Next thing, I was a minority in the business that I'd started above my garage, listed on the stock market. And then, it didn't really work out. And with at the time, I was very angry because you can imagine, you start something yourself, you build, it's your life's work. I'd spent 15 years building the business. But afterwards, with time, everything happens for a good reason. And then after a year's gardening leave and an inordinate amount of money that they were paying me, every month, I then decided that I was going to be doing television work and writing a column, literally two columns a week. I'd be doing one for the FM, one for Business Day, which back in those days were giants of the financial journalism area, and doing a show on CNBC Africa, which I'd done in the past, and sending out a newsletter. And I sent out the first of my newsletters, which was called Boardroom Talk, which had predated MoneyWeb. Boardroom Talk was, it started that in 95, and MoneyWeb started in 96. Anyway, I then got this fat lawyer's letter, High Court summons from Caxton, who were then the controlling shareholders of MoneyWeb. And it was a cease and desist. And initially I thought, this is great. Let's go to court. Let's go and expose them and fight with them, because you do that, when you're angry and you're antagonistic. But my lawyer eventually said to me, it's going to cost you a lot of money. We'll win. We'll win because your list predates the starting of MoneyWeb, which they now have control of. But it's going to cost you a fortune. I mean, unfortunately, lawfare in South Africa is a very expensive business. And so I said, okay, that's fine. But then my mind changed. My plans changed. I said, if these big guys are that scared of you that they are prepared to try and silence you from even just sending out a newsletter, well, maybe there's something in it. So I reassessed. The late Andrew Trench, I was really sad to hear that Andrew passed away this week. Indeed, he helped me to set up a white letter of a website. I didn't know how to do those things because back in MoneyWeb, Tim Wood was my partner there or colleague there. He was the guy who did all the tech. But Andrew helped me to start BizNews, and that's how it began. My nephew was our webmaster. He was a marine biologist. My wife, Jeanette, she was very involved right from the outset in posting stories and so on. And it just went from there, and BizNews has been it's been an unbelievable success. I own the company, and MoneyWeb, I only had, eventually, only 18% at the end of the day. So everything's worked out for the best. I've been able to apply my knowledge, not just from the digital world, but I've been a journalist for, 45 years. And all of that has then been applied into BizNews. And I promise you, Byron, every day that I wake up, I'm as excited as I was on that very first day back in 1980. So, I've been one of the lucky ones.
It's unusual for I'm going to get crucified for saying this, so please, please forgive me. It's unusual for a man of your experience in years to be on YouTube. I mean, obviously, YouTube is generally considered a young guy's game, right? And you know, even I'm even getting too old for it. But you know, it's interesting that YouTube actually offers the ability to grow businesses like this and to get messages out and to reach an audience. What is your experience of like starting on YouTube and then growing and then you're just watching your channel grow? I mean, obviously you get the channel stats, right? And you can see how your subscriber goes and your view count goes. I mean, it's quite a roller coaster to be on that. How have you found it being a YouTuber?
Well, you must remember I have the benefit of having stuck to one career, one area for my whole life. Hmm. There's only one thing I know, and that's media. I mean, we've all got opinions on politics and pretty much everything else. I know a bit about the economy as well because I've been a financial journalist all this time. But media is my passion, and I understand that. So when the internet came along, I discovered it for myself in 1995 when a colleague showed me. I had a brief period in the corporate world. And he was the head of tech at ABSA, and he called me into his office and he said he'd just come back from Armac with IBM, and he said, look at this thing, it's called the internet. And I said, wow, because I had been publishing before with very modest success. No printing costs, no distribution costs. Hello, this is something new. So I threw it all up, I gave it all up and invested heavily on the internet. So right in the early stages. And what happened with YouTube has been something very similar. I've seen, from my particular perspective, that you can reach many more people than the internet. When you have a look at websites, for instance, I see websites as the way I saw newspapers back in the 90s. Newspapers were very old, very bad technology. People, you know, in the initial stages, I can't tell you how many people said, oh, but I like the feel of ink on my paper, on my hands when I read the newspaper. I mean, total garbage. But there's an investment in it, and you worry about maybe the transformation, the change. And here in South Africa, we were really, really nailed because we had one supplier of bandwidth, which was Telkom, and they charged exponentially more than anywhere else in the world. So that really hurt South Africa's development of the internet. Similar when you go a little bit further and you have a look, websites, you know, people don't read anymore. They might look at the headlines, but we know the stats. BizNews is a big website, eh? Don't forget. I mean, we've been in the millions plus users per month for a long, long time. Obviously, like everybody else, it's tapered off. And we could then see that on YouTube, it was a far different experience. You can get more in depth, you can actually absorb it better, and you can learn a heck of a lot more, especially in a nation where people don't read. I heard a book publisher tell me recently, the CEO of Exclusive Books, Grattan Kirk, said to me, there are 100,000 people in South Africa who read books. I mean, think of that. That's a tiny, tiny market. And yeah, you take it.
I think
one
that's
step
a worldwide
further.
Thing, though, isn't it? I think when you actually look like globally, the amount of people that now read is it's in the very small percentile.
I don't know the global figures, but I just thought, whoa! In South Africa, 100,000 people read, but yet you get millions. I mean, we have well over a million people who watch BizNews. We get down 6 million. Videos a month get downloaded, average time 10 minutes per download. I mean, these are mind-blowing stats, especially if you come from an industry, a media industry, where people claimed all kinds of things which were complete bullshit, claimed numbers, you know, 15 readers per copy, and the advertisers swallowed it. Yay. I'm talking about a newspaper. How's it possible to have 15 people reading a newspaper or a magazine? But it just became fact because it was repeated so much. But anyway, you take it one step further, you take it to YouTube, and you can see why YouTube is so successful and why guys like you who talk sense and are actually prepared to go out there and tell the truth, to address the Uber truths, are so popular. And we've seen that at BizNews as well, is that we, you know, we're not there to plug any particular line. We're there to give people who do not always have the access to channels or platforms, to give them access. And it works, because everybody wants to, most human beings, I believe, really are seeking truth, and they do like to see different opinions. And we will not tell you, I will never ever, I'll tell you my opinion from time to time, but I won't tell you what you should think and what you should believe. Listen to these guys on both sides of the spectrum, on all sides of the spectrum rather, not both sides, and make up your own mind. And I think YouTube gives you that ability. You can see, you can look at the whites of the eyes. You can understand the guy's body language. Is he passionate about what he's talking about, or is he just the talking head that some PR guy has filled with information? Remember, I had a national radio show for 15, 18 years, and I met them all. Everyone came through my studio. At one stage, it was the only game in town. And the guys would come through my studio, and you could see those who had been prepped, who'd been set up, who really were cardboard cutouts, and you could see those who were superb the thinkers and individuals who could add value. When you go through so many people that you interview, it becomes quite obvious. And on YouTube, you have the added advantage, it's not just radio, is that you have time at your disposal, and you can see the person, and you can actually see whether or not they're telling you the truth. So it's a fantastic, fantastic vehicle. And remember, sorry, one last thing, Byron. I have struggled my whole career when not being able to get a license. I've rescued two radio stations, but never allowed to own them. I'm the wrong skin color. I'm not going to go into that. But as a South African, you could have been born at the wrong time or the right time, depending on how you want to define it. But as an entrepreneur, it's never been easy to be an entrepreneur in the media sector. And hello, here comes YouTube, who says, no problems with licenses, but no problems with who you know.
Do what you want, yeah.
Exactly. It's who are you? What is your meritocracy? And I mean, that really turns me on.
Yeah. So there's so much you've said here that I want to unpack. So, I mean, the YouTube thing is interesting. I agree with you on all those fronts. YouTube, myself, as an example, I would never get platformed on News24 or ENCA or whatever. And I'm an attorney by trade. I'm a lawyer by trade, or profession, if you want to be specific. And I know that there's certain things that I always say in my video, because they protect me. But I always say at the end of my videos, these are just my opinions. I invite people to comment, because obviously if I ever get alleged that I'm misreporting or trying to push a particular policy or party line, it's easy for me to distance myself from that. And I do try to have a degree of independence. I feel I criticize everybody equally. But that in itself allows me to do certain things. And I'll give you a couple examples just to illustrate what you're saying about YouTube, right? So the first example is that a lot of the time, like, I'll interview people and you let people talk, and the media doesn't allow people to do that. They interfere, they disrupt, they push, they get antagonistic, and they're waiting for that gotcha moment. I gotcha. And if you want a really good example of that, watch any interview with Piers Morgan. Like, it's insufferable. Like, the guy can't get any words out, he can't articulate. But in doing that, as you rightly say, we allow people to independently form their own opinion based on what they see. And that's good and bad. It's bad for people like, I actually interviewed him twice, Herman Mashaba. And the interviews were disastrous. Not for me, by the way. They were disastrous for him. Because you're asking questions and you just sit back and you're like, talk, bud. But he had nothing to say. He had nothing of value to add. And I actually did follow on things where I dissected my own interviews, and I'm like, I'm asking the guy a question, he doesn't have anything to say. I'm asking him what his policy is on this, and he doesn't have anything to say. It's just deflection and diversion. And in that instance, it becomes like really obvious because I platform somebody and just allow them to just talk, just go for it, talk. But the legacy media, say legacy because it's a legacy of the past, right? I mean, the media as it's currently framed is there's a historical artifact. It's not, in many instances, it's not evolving. And in some instances, they're trying. Like I see News 24 just did I think they've started a YouTube channel with like a podcast type vibe, you know, where they do dissecting news and analysis. Oh, I wonder where that comes from. But they're trying to get in on our territories now, a bit late, if you will. But it becomes obvious to most individuals now that a lot of what they push is a line. And it's not necessarily the truth. It's what they kind of want you to know. And YouTube doesn't have that. It's a free market of ideas platform, as you very rightly say. It's, you know, I can say my stuff, you can say your stuff, people can watch you, they can watch me, they can form their own opinion. I'm not telling them what to think. You know, they can go watch Kaglejo on Citizen Concern and form their opinion. If they want, they can go watch all the radical guys, you know, the guys who don't agree with us. But it's interesting that you talk about the manufacturedness of the news, because I believe, my opinion, that an example is Dan Corder on ENCA. I mean, Dad is clearly an establishment guy. They've gone and got him because he fits that agenda. He fits that makeup of that organization. And it was interesting that when he was on YouTube, he had greater numbers than he has on ENCA. And that's because people can tell. They can tell it's manufactured. To me, it seems like the audience has become more, should we say, astute of the messaging that they're getting. I think maybe since COVID, the messaging that people get in some news platforms is becoming more, it's becoming more clear to them. They're becoming more switched on. And because of that, they seek things like you, you know, somebody independent. Just have a chat, let people talk, look them in the face, give them a platform to talk. Do you get a sense of what I'm saying?
Yeah, no, I do. I don't know Dan Corber. I've never met him. I don't know what his background is, so I can't pass any comment on that one. The reality is, though, with this new channel, you're going to get people who are bright. You're going to get people exposed who otherwise would probably not get in the door at a legacy media organization. You know, I started my work at The Citizen. My very, very first job was at The Citizen. And within 10 months, I was made an offer at the Rand Daily Mail. Worked like hell and focused on my area. But now you can imagine this. The Citizen was a party line supporting the National Party. The Rand Daily Mail was a party line supporting anti-apartheid. So one day you're doing this work, the next day you're doing a different work. The good fortune for me, I suppose, is that I've always been a financial journalist. It's only in recent times that we've moved towards the political economy, because actually the reality is, in a developing country like South Africa, if you don't get the politics right, forget the economy. And we've seen that the last 17 years. We've had contraction of GDP per capita here in South Africa. We're going backwards at a rapid rate in this country because we haven't got the politics right. So we need to look at and expose the politics. And I think much more is being done now by various voices and from across the spectrum. I love what Paul Walsh is doing, for instance. He's talking to people, and that's the point you made earlier. It's talking to voices that perhaps wouldn't have been heard in the past. And he himself came back from Oxford with this dreadful reputation created by his enemies in legacy media. I mean, it, like, the whole thing is just weird. But if you, in 1991, after Madiba was released from jail, my pal who worked at the SABC bugged me for the however manyth time at Jerry Skaterman. He said, come, man, you've got to come and work here now. I'd always turned them down because the SABC pre that period was a propaganda machine. It was just one voice. It was not a public broadcaster. It was a state broadcaster. And so I thought, well, let's go. And that's where I learned, that's where I was exposed for the first time to television and to radio. And it gave me the first taste for this medium, which in most of the other countries around the world is by far the dominant medium. But what did I know? I was a writer. You know, I was a journalist, a writer. What did I know about broadcasting? So I started reading the people and watching interviews. And the person that I thought was the best of the best was David Frost. And I read his autobiography. And David Frost put it beautifully. He said, talking about Gotcha, he said, you've got two types of journalists. You've got those who want to be the star and those who want to facilitate. And I decided from day one, I want to be like David Frost. I want to be the facilitator. And he said, when you've done a great interview, the person doing the interviews is not even remembered. You don't remember that. And in other words, if I'm interviewing Herman Mashaba, the people watching it will remember Herman Mashaba, but they wouldn't know that Hogg was involved there. Well, they might remember, but that's not the purpose. The purpose is, what does this guy say? And exactly the point that you made earlier, we are not there to make it obvious. Yeah, human beings are incredibly smart. In our business, we say, and it's again something that I learned a long, long time ago, never underestimate the intelligence of your audience. Never overestimate their knowledge. So it's like the work we do, we are exposed to knowledge all the time. We don't have to, you know, do a day job. Our day job is accumulation of knowledge, being exposed to knowledge. We get a lot of nonsense thrown at us, and you have to try and differentiate between it. But if you just start from that basis, and then you go one step further, because of the work I do, I know a little bit about a hell of a lot of stuff. But when it comes to the detail on a particular area, I'm almost certain that there are people in the community we serve, not certain, I know, there are people in the community we serve who know a hell of a lot more about that subject than I do. And that's what keeps me, keeps my feet on the ground, to understand I don't really know much about this. You know, Aristotle said the beginning of wisdom was the fact that I know nothing. And I keep reminding myself of that. Shit, I know nothing. But I will ask somebody who knows something on a subject. And when they start opining, just because, oh, I read this or I think this, then I stop being interested. But when they tell me about their personal experiences, then I get excited. So for me, having done this work for so long and having engaged with so many people who have been some really brilliant and some not so much, it's enriched my life enormously to remember that when I talk about legal stuff, shit, don't just remember Byron's a lawyer and he knows a hell of a lot more about this shit than you do. So don't try and opine on stuff that you don't understand or it isn't depth. And that's why, I don't often have a discussion like this. I don't do interviews because I really know two things. As I said to you earlier, I know the media industry, and not too many people are really interested in the media industry, excepting those in the media industry. And I know a bit about economics and running a business because I've started a few businesses. I started and listed MoneyWeb, and I'm delighted that it's still going, and well done to the guys there for keeping it going. And the same thing with BizNews. You know, two startups. Yeesh. You talk to the guys in the startup industry, they say, are you nuts? One startup is more than enough for one lifetime. But thank heavens we persevered, and it's 11 years longer on now with BizNews. And the overnight sensation has taken 25 years to get there, you know, so – It is what it is, and we're still sticking to the same principle, which is we serve a community, and we don't know more than our community, but we will give our community the best insights possible. And I mean, it sounds trite, and it sounds, you know, apple pie, what, motherhood and apple pie kind of stuff, but that's what I've done in my whole career, and it's worked for me. I'm still doing the same stuff, and there are not many people who were around in my early days who are still in the field that I'm in, and I'm having as much fun today, as I said, as I did when I first started. So Lucky guy.
So I've got to ask you a question then on that front. So you've interviewed so many people. Who is your favorite?
Oh, shit, no. You can't say that. It's impossible. That's impossible. I tell you what, I would have loved to have interviewed Warren Buffett. Oh, man. I never got there. I met him a few times. I actually had dinner with his son, Howard. That was through a different channel, another part of my life. And I would have loved to have chatted to Buffett. What used to happen at the Berkshire Hathaway AGM, until he turned 80, man, he's what, 94, so it just shows how long ago it was. I cracked a nod, don't ask me how, to a press conference of 30 people on the Sunday. Now, what happens at the Berkshire Hathaway AGM? 40,000 people go there. That some extend the whole night to get to a microphone so they can ask a question of Warren Buffett in the 5 hours that he answers questions. But we, as those 30 guys in the, journalists, we got to each ask a question. So I've asked him a number of questions over the years directly on things that were of interest to me and to our community. But no, that wasn't it. One of the first interviews that I did that I remember was at the SABC just after I'd started there in 1991. I was at the International Monetary Fund and I had a cameraman with me. And there was another young guy there from the BBC, very brash and outspoken and loud and everything else. And he said, hey, you got a cameraman, I got a cameraman. Why don't we have a two-camera shoot? You interviewing Kam Dasu, who was the managing director of the the International Monetary Fund. I'm interviewing Kam Dasu. We'll get the two cameras, much better than a one-camera shot. So that's what we did. And that was Richard Quest. So it's extraordinary to think that brash guy who was even then larger than life, had gone on to do other things. But I remember that interview very well. I remember because it was early on in one's career, and I think a lot of the times that happens. I had an interview with a CEO of a company called CS Holdings called Annette van der Laan, who'd crooked the books, and she was in our MoneyWeb studios at President Place. She'd come in and she couldn't answer the question. She broke down, but she'd stolen effectively money from shareholders and she was drummed out. And she was like the heroine of the Afrikaner business community at that stage. And that was the end of her career because we'd exposed what she was doing. And I've had some crooks, Brett Kebble, Roger Kebble, oh man, it's a long, it's been a long and fascinating and interesting career, but I still, the one that got away was Warren Buffett.
Pick your top three, come on man. Pick three that you can think to yourself like, yeah. Even if they weren't your favorites, like they weren't the best interviews you did, they were ones you just really enjoyed, like... Who have you really enjoyed interviewing that you've just been like, the time just disappeared? Oh, you're like, I didn't even know how long that took.
It always does. Time does disappear. Byron, I can't. There's just too many. Seriously. I mean, you've been doing this for a hell of a long time. So on camera or on air, on radio, there really just have been, there've been so many exceptional human beings that I've been privileged to be exposed to and I've learned so much from. Simon Sinek. I mean, wow, what a guy. He was amazing. Mr. 5 a.m. Club, I can't even remember his name now, but he was extraordinary. He came into the studio. Rich Dad, Poor Dad. He used to make a point of coming in to see me. And there was a lady, another... Kiyosaki, hey? Guys like that. I mean, and probably my favorite, actually my favorite of all favorites was Tony Bazan, the mind mapping guy. I met him in Davos. I've been going to Davos it'll be my 20th time next year. And it was an extraordinary place.
Oh, there you go, ladies and gentlemen. You heard it first. Alex Holger's captured by the WEF.
Captured? No, I'm not captured. I can assure you I'm not captured by anybody. That's for Anybody who knows me knows.
Jeremy Nell, that's it. That's it. You're all over his podcast now.
And poor old Klaus. I mean, he's this harmless old fella, Klaus Schwab, who truly, he's like the world's best schmoozer. That's how he put the WEF together. He's just schmoozing. And he's Dr. Evil because he looks like Austin Powers. But Tony Bazan, I met him in Davos. It's probably 18, 19 years ago. He's the guy who invented mind mapping. And I learned so much from Tony. We were at the same hotel and we had breakfast and chatted a little bit. And what used to happen in Davos then, not so much anymore, is they would have their press team would organize press conferences for these guys. And there have been a number that I've gone to where I've been the only person at the press conference. And I was the only person with Tony Bazan. I was also one of only two people who pitched to David Cameron's press conference. I was the only guy who pitched to a press conference with the Prime Minister of Pakistan. And, exactly. Interesting guy, though. Anyway, so you know, there are just so many of those that you wouldn't be right.
So let's talk about what you've learned so far. So you mentioned the state of South Africa at the moment. Obviously, the state of South Africa is what it is. Talk to a lot of people about the current economic state of the place. What's your feeling? Let's take away from the analysts for a moment and say you with all the things that you've heard and all the things that you've spoken to people about, are you positive or negative on the trajectory of South Africa?
I think that to be a journalist, you have to be positive. You have to be a positive person. I can't see if you start sliding into the cynical camp, it's time to get out of the industry. That's the first thing, because people need hope. And it's so easy to talk bad stuff. It's very difficult sometimes to see a little bit of sunshine, or a little bit of perspective. I wouldn't say sunshine because that sounds like, you know, sunshine journalism, but just perspective. And often we in the media industry, we go from one extreme to the other. I mean, I'm not talking about guys who masquerade as journalists, and it's unfortunately too many of those. They get told what to say and then they say it. They've got people behind them. They've got vested interests. This is the party line. As I said, when I was at the Citizen and the Rand Daily Mail, that was the party line. That was the party line. That was what you followed, and that was it. And of course, today we have a very different scenario where many of the voices who are being consumed from a media perspective have no party lines to follow. So you and I are going to cock it up often with our own thoughts and ideas, but that's because we don't know everything. And we, as of this point in time, that's what we think we know. My background and being in financial journalism and economics, and you know, I read Hayek for fun. That's a different. That gives me a different. Maybe the one part that I do know a little bit about. Now, if I look at South Africa, it's an absolute tragedy what's happened to our economy. But if you go back, you know, who's to blame and why did we get here, etc. There was a heck of a lot of expediency that came into it. Remember at the time of the transition, it was funny, I'd just been to India and I'd had an amazing trip around there with Tata. They were coming into South Africa. They took a bunch of South African journalists. They used to do it in those days. They don't seem to do it anymore. So they took a bunch of South African journalists and they took us to all around India, including a place called Jamshedpur, which is where the founder of Tata started a steel plant 150 years ago, whatever it was. And it's in the middle. It's this place in the middle of nowhere, which is hard in India because it's, well, very highly populated, with 1 million people, so a very small town by their standards. And it's now a flourishing place of 1 million people, relatively flourishing in Indian context. But reading what the founder of Tata did back in those days, it was around the time they were, I think, was still part of the Raj then, but they said when they invested into the future, they would empower people, the next generation, by putting all of the money that Tata earned into a trust. All of the equity. The Tata family only ever had 2% of Tata's stock. I mean, interesting, huh? So the vast majority of the equity in Tata are in trusts, and those trusts fund education for people. And that's true empowerment. So, of course, I come back to South Africa from my India visit, all excited because we're now in the transition in our country, and everybody's looking for ways that we can empower those who'd been previously disadvantaged. And so help me, nobody's listening to this story. All they're listening to is, oh no, but we've got to make people rich. We've got to empower the few that we choose. And who are the few we choose? Well, the guys that we like, the guys we can talk to, the people whose accents are like ours. They might not look like ours, and I'm talking here from those who had the power, the business community. And it was an opportunity lost. I remember going on to television one night in about 96 and criticizing a deal that Absa had done with Tokyo Sekhwali, where they had given him share options, which if you use the Black-Scholes model, were worth 1.3 billion rand. But because it's share options, in other words, we haven't given you equity, we're giving you options to buy equity, they could fool everybody that we didn't have to put in our balance sheet and in our income statement. But actually what you were doing was you were giving Tokyo Sekhwali a gift of a billion, and he wasn't the only one. There were many, many like him. And what was Tokyo's claim to fame? Well, he was the premier of Gauteng province. He was high up in the ANC. He was tipped. It was Tokyo, Matthew Siposa, and Cyril Ramaphosa were the three who were tipped to succeed Thabo Mbeki. And so Absa, bless their hearts, thought this was the way to secure their future. And they weren't alone. There were many, many like that. And now we've reaped the whirlwind. Now we get a government which is saying, oh, we need 100 black industrialists that we can give a billion rand to each. I mean, seriously? Have you lost your minds? You're taking my tax money to make some oak that you pick, a black industrialist, because you just think he's going to be a black industrialist. What's his qualifications? Same as yours, Cyril, where you were, you know.
Got an ANC card, so that makes him applicable.
No. You know, it's actually interesting. Extraordinary when you look at the mismanagement of an opportunity, Byron. That's my thought.
So let's use myself as an example, right? I'll tell you my personal experience. You know, a lot of people accuse us of many things without knowing our situations, but I got taken to the United Kingdom when I was like 16. I got taken there because my parents wanted to immigrate, and so that's where we went. I came back here in later years when I decided I wanted to come home and raise a family and do whatever else in the country of my birth. So, you know, I came back. You can't accuse me of being a apartheid beneficiary because I wasn't raised in that generation, and I was outside of the country when I got my education, when I got any form of money. I came back here and I set businesses up. I brought money into the country. So now let's talk about that. Let's say, for example, one of the things I have is I own a pub, and we have gambling machines in the pub, like most pubs do. I'm limited to five machines, and I can't get more than that, even if I overperform, because I'm not black. If I want any more machines in there, I have to give some of my business away. I have to give it away to a previously disadvantaged individual. How is that fair?
No, of course it's not.
That's considered economic redress. No, but it's not economic redress, because the business that's there, I've established, I built myself. It's my hard work and my money that I brought abroad. It's not that they came from my parents and they got it from apartheid or some other rubbish. It's money I pulled into the country to establish one of these businesses of mine. and I am limited in terms of growth opportunities on that business through nothing more than the virtue of my skin. That's it. Nothing, no other reason. And they'll claim, well, apart that beneficiary, or you were advantaged in the past, or whatever else. But that's not the case. I wasn't old enough to be advantaged. I never worked in South Africa until I came back in my later years. Apartheid was finished like a long time ago. 20, 25 years apartheid had been finished. But that's the state of BE in the country. And that's unfortunately also one of the reasons that the South African government's having, you know, powwows with Elon Musk, because Elon's the same, right? He left the country. He's slightly different. I mean, he comes from a wealthy family and so forth, but the argument that he'll make is that he built SpaceX abroad, it was his creation, now he's going to come here, and just to set up and get a license, he's going to give some of the company away. For what? You know, he didn't pull money out of South Africa, he would say. Whether you believe that or not, I don't know. I'm not there to criticize his family. But it's become very difficult to justify forms of these BE policies 32 years after the end of apartheid. And, you know, we've been doing this for, what, 25, 30 years now? Like, we've done this. But the problem now is the idea of BE is so entrenched in the establishment that, I mean, I saw the other day, as you know, they're trying to relax the rules for Starlink, right? And the one ANC minister came out and said he thought it was deeply, deeply sickening, were his exact words, because they would dare to consider relaxing the rules on BE. That's where we are now, right? It's sickening to think that somebody might not have BE. Sickening. That's not redress, bud. That's we've graduated beyond that now.
Yeah, look, it's. I mean, this whole thing is all. It's all politics. It's all ideology. It's all self. Self-interest. We know that the IRR's research shows that the vast majority of South Africans do not believe in BEE, and it's not the vast majority. You're not talking about the 7% of white South Africans. It is nonsense, and we all know it. We've seen so many good people leave the country because they can't get a fair shake of the dice. The fact that there were crazy things that happened in our country 50, 100 years ago. And there I'm talking about the 1913 Lands Act. I mean, that's appalling. There were crazy, stupid, idiotic things, but they happened in a lot of places in the world. You had evil people running and determining the future. The fact nowadays is evil people are not that able to perpetrate their evil on broader society because we have information. So today people can see what the hell is going on. Back in those days, it was very easy to say, well, I don't know what's going on, etc. And it is a fact that today we're in a completely different environment. The whole BEE thing to me, where the mirage disappears is when you have a look at it, at the legal premium that can be charged on according to law and according to Treasury is worth 150 billion rand a year. So in other words, completely above board, if you have got a business A that is prepared to do the work for you as a public enterprise for 100 million rand, you can go to business B, which is a appropriate BEE-owned business, and you can then get 111 billion rand. You can give them 11 billion rand over and above it, and it gets ticked off. So what are you doing? You're just getting rent-seeking. And so how do you make money? No, you don't. You don't sacrifice and you don't get up early in the morning and work harder. You just make sure you know the right people so that you can be that who gets that 11 billion extra perfectly legally. But the good news about all of this, and you did ask me earlier, am I optimistic or not? I'm incredibly optimistic about South Africa. I think this place is just the most awesome place in the world. Okay, I've traveled a lot. I've seen just about everywhere. I haven't been to Russia, but I've been pretty much everywhere else. I love South Africa. I love the people. I love the sparkling eyes, the shining eyes. I believe Bobby Godsell when he says, this is a country that seems forever to have been blessed by its people but cursed by its governors. And if you go back hundreds of years, that is where we have been. We've had governors who've been just made a real mess. But there's something in the water, something in the DNA, something in the society here that once we find ourselves, we will be a world beater. And how are we going to find ourselves? Only by getting to a rock bottom, getting to a place where everybody sees this and says, now, come on. I mean, seriously, ANC, do you really think we're that stupid? Do you really think that because you don't want to cut your costs in government, we must pay 2% extra VAT? Do you really think that we're going to get sucked in here, that you're going to now create 100 people who are going to be your industrialists, that you're going to give R1 billion each? Do you think we're that thick? Do you think we're that stupid?
They've done it before, though. They did it before. I think they put money before in the industrial development, and then the last I checked, the amount of industrialists that were still there was like in the single digits. I mean, if you remember in Quebeca, where I live, they invested billions on that factory to create vaccines. But it never produced one vaccine, and then they closed it. They had that big thing with that Chinese guy who was from America, where they basically had him as the BE beneficiary, and they built this factory, and they were like, it's going to do all these vaccines and everything. It was big presses. Cyril was there shaking people's hands. Never developed one vaccine because they said they never got any orders for it. There's the well-known case of the cell phone manufacturer. They invested, and if you know anything about cell phones, like they have to get done in pristine environments. They created this factory to create cell phones. They were going to create the cell phone in South Africa that they're going to send out. It would have the operating system of Ubuntu and all the other stuff. They created a few phones and the whole factory collapsed. It's a very well-known case. That was billions spent by the taxpayers on industrialization. We have so many of these stories. Look at the chicken farm. I said this actually, I forget who I was interviewing the other day. But I was interviewing someone and I said on a podcast the other day, how do you lose money on chicken in South Africa? That's not to be funny. It's just that in South Africa, like, people eat chicken by the bucket loads. How do you lose money on chicken? We have a chicken farm, the largest chicken farm in South Africa right now, which is state owned in the north of the country, that's failing. It's cost the country billions. How do you lose money on chicken?
Yeah, okay. How? So all of those are facts. All of those are realities. All of those have taken us 30 plus years to get to. However, 5 years ago, you would not have believed, or you would have believed that Jacob Zuma had a point. Sorry, not five, 10 years ago. He had a point when he said the ANC will rule till the second coming. Now they're at 40. The people have woken up, and when you listen carefully to what's coming out of the pollsters and guys it's their work to know these things, they're saying that this slide is now accelerating because those who voted for the ANC under duress or stayed away, for the first time, they see that the ANC below 50% has not sparked a chaos in the country.
Mm.
And as a consequence, it is safe to not vote for them. The feedback I'm getting is very strong, that the ANC is behaving today like the National Party behaved in the early 1990s. They knew it was over. We forget these things, you know? When did Vodacom start? Byron? 1993, the licenses were granted. Have a look at many of the things that were granted just before the apartheid government departed. And you will see that politicians, when they know their time is over, boy, do they guts themselves on what's available. And the feedback I'm getting is that it's a similar situation that we're in now. And that is, for me, that is room for great hope and great encouragement, because it means that those who are closest to the fire can see that the game is up. The game is up. And so they're now moving on. You know, for Cyril to have said what he said last week in Parliament, I mean, this is not a stupid man. This is not a guy who doesn't understand how the economy works, how the global economy works. And he starts trotting out 1920 Soviet-style garbage in Parliament. Why?
I did a video on it.
He wants to keep it going. He wants to keep, you know, let's just keep what we've got for the moment as long as we can. Maybe he's doing that subconsciously. Maybe he's doing it completely consciously. But the game is up for these guys. And the game is up because their constituency, the people who always voted ANC, know that these guys have sold them down the river. So that's why I'm excited. I, when we come out the other side of this, I really believe that this country is going to be, it's one of the best positioned in the world if we're truly non-aligned. And don't buy this bullshit that we must now be America's best friend. Stay non-aligned. That is where the power lies. Play both sides. You know, and that's where Cyril has been such a disappointment, because
but Cyril doesn't play both sides. He plays the sides.
Of course he does. You're right.
They claim non-aligned, but they are very aligned. But they're aligned with the very people that aren't going to be the investors in the country. Which actually does, I mean, you mentioned America now, so I have to ask you this even before we finish this. What's your view on the refugee thing?
If you want to go tomorrow and live in another country, and if you have the good fortune to be given a green card, which people pay $5 million to acquire.
That's the golden visa, for those of you who don't know. That's the golden visa rules, yeah.
Shit, who am I to stand in the way and criticize you? These guys, I don't know if the refugees are deserving of going to America. That's for the Americans to decide whether they are high on the list or low on whatever. I mean, I have no clue whether they're telling the truth, whether they're not telling the truth, whether they're embellishing for effect, whether they are actually people who've really suffered from crime and violence. But what I can say to you is I cannot begrudge, as a rational thinker, I cannot begrudge somebody who takes up the opportunity to go into the United States of America, where there are millions, tens, hundreds of millions of people who would love to go and live there, but they don't have the $5 million that the very wealthy people have. So come on. I mean, it's just common sense.
So if you were, so let's say I was coming to you and I said, hey, got my family, thinking of immigrating. You said you're positive on the country. Would you tell people to go? Would you tell them to stay?
No, never, ever, ever tell someone to go. That is going to be your own decision. I've been, we have family in Australia. I love our family in Australia, and they've made a wonderful life for themselves there. I'm still trying to get my niece back, but unfortunately, every day that passes, she and her husband and their little family, in addition to the other family, are likely to get more embedded. I want to do what I can in my country to make this country good enough for them to want to come back voluntarily. I think that we have got a wonderful future, but if you have particular circumstance that are blocking your progress or your joy, your happiness, your freedom. And, you know, some people live in very difficult circumstance. And if they're in a difficult circumstance, I cannot judge. I can't judge anyone. We cannot judge anybody. We don't live in their skins. And if that's one thing that life has taught me, is that I really have to stop, I have to fight my own propensity for judgment of others and circumstances. If someone came to me and said, I'm thinking of emigrating, give me a direct answer. Right now, I'd say, are you entrepreneurial? or are you a corporate animal? I'm talking about a young person. And if the young person says, no, I'm risk averse, I'm a corporate animal, and they're white or Indian or colored, I'd say think carefully, because your path is going to be very difficult. Through no fault of your own or your parents, we have a circumstance in South Africa where certain population groups have had an advantage over others, and there is going to be the politicians, because they get voted into power by those who have the numbers. They are going to play that card for as long as they possibly can. Whether it's rational or irrational is irrelevant. However, if you are entrepreneurial, you will not find a better country in the world than South Africa to make a living and to actually make a good life for yourself. Just know, to a degree, like the English-speaking entrepreneurs did during the apartheid era, you're not going to get supported by government. Just know, government's out. That's blocked to you. So if you're doing something where you compete with government, you've got a fantastic opportunity, because government is being stuffed full of cadres who are inefficient, and government will be inefficient, and there's only so much money to go around. You can't keep bailing out, as we know, from SAA and Eskom. So that's would be my advice to someone. Entrepreneurial, shit, man. There's no better place in the world to be than here. But if you're a corporate animal, I would say just you probably got to think about it, and let us make this country, by transforming, let us make it work towards making it deserving of bringing you back here, where you can bring your talents back to our country and support the whole. So again, it might sound like I'm coming from a different planet, but that's the way I see this world.
I think it's very positive, and on that, I'll take up more of your time. It'd be nearly an hour, but I think it's a very, very positive place to end. You've had a very exciting time on Biz News. It sounds like you've gone through a lot of adversary to create it. It's great to see it growing, and I hope that you'll soon get that that gold YouTube plaque. You know, the gold YouTube plaque of 100, a million subscribers. That'd be great. My one suggestion to you is you need to put the plaque up, man. Where's the plaque?
Oh, you got the plaque behind you. Oh my word! What is that?
It's the 100,000.
100,000. Well done.
Great. Where's yours? Come on, man! You got to put it up. It's got to be front and center.
Oh, put it on the wall. We're not so good at marketing, but we will want. No. You know, it's we're very proud of the fact that people love our channel and keep coming back, and it's growing every month. And it's you must remember, when you've had a business in an industry, you've had a career in an industry where there have always been other people making the rules for you, and the people making the rules have not necessarily had the best interests of your community that you serve at heart, or your best interest, but they've had the best interests of their pockets at heart. And they have kept out competitors for as much as possible. I told you about the Telkom example. Radio licenses in South Africa were even worse. They licensed for profitability. For those who understand business, radio stations in South Africa, until YouTube and podcasting came along, used to generate 50% EBITDA margins. Now, you know, in a good business, 10% is a good margin. 50%. So for every rand that you got from an advertiser, 50 cents went straight into profit. It's just like mind-blowing. And the reason for that was that they never issued enough radio licenses. So you had, when you talked a bit earlier about platforming or deplatforming and that, there was no platforming unless you went through the door that they wanted to open for you. So when you now look behind you, you've got 100,000 plus subscribers. Hey, pat yourself on the back, because I can tell you that is bigger than virtually not all radio stations, but the vast majority of radio stations in South Africa. And that is another thing that makes me very optimistic, not just about South Africa, but about the world, is that we've got it's like a dam that's broken. And information is now flowing freely. And as long as we are not there to try and screw the system to our own advantage, or have agendas that are twisted through, I don't know, you know, malevolent means, then this system will really work to everyone's advantage. That's my view on it.
Great place to end. Thank you, Alex, for your time.
My pleasure. Cheers, Brian.